New Zealand Opal today. Caricature from Galen Stanton Heights, who also knew Carmen and Miranda, as did Mick. So we got them all except, there's more. A raw Italian appetizer. Oh my gosh, a raw. I don't know that one. Gail mentioned cartoon. VW made a cabriolet. Close. From Dawn in Bethel Park. We need an R there. If it were a cabriolet, we'd be good. Pudge was happy to hear his wifey poo on the radio. Oh, Nick says it's cartouche, the hieroglyph answer. And Gail confirms carabiner is correct. And she also knew cartouche, as did a listener whose number ends in 674. What a busy and wonderful morning. Oh, the appetizer. Thank you. Carpaccio. Carpaccio. Thank you. Mick just shared that with us. Broadcasting live from historic Allegheny Square, along with Ricky Berger. This is Larry Berger, and this is the show that gets your weekend off to a good start. Our Youth Express Hour is next. Stick around. It's going to be meaningful and unique. I think you'll really enjoy it. You're listening to the show that gets your weekend off to a good start, the Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings at WRCT Pittsburgh, WIUP-FM, Indiana, WMCO, New Concord, KRDP, Apache Junction, Goldfield, Ghost Town, Phoenix, WSHA-FM, Grove City, WCUC-FM, Clarion, WNJR, Washington, WKYW-LP, Kaiser, West Virginia, Mountain Streams, Radio.org, Tube City Online at WMCK.FM, Keysport, and SLBRadio.org/radio, where you will find links to our own player, TuneIn, Simple Radio, Streama, Radio Garden, and our Listen by Phone feature, where you can listen by calling
6312 8728. Wake up, darling, go eat and go get me my gun. Man for trouble, but a die before I'd run. So dig a hole in the meadow, dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow, gonna lay down and go bring down. Sitting on the banks of the sea, she had a 44 around her body and a banjo on her knee. So dig a hole in the meadow, dig a hole in the cold, cold ground. Dig a hole in the meadow, gonna lay all the concrete down. Coming from 10 miles to the house down.
is a song that's been done by lots of folks. In that case, the Wilson Banjo Company, Darlin' Corey, its name. Sometimes the song is called Dig a Hole or Dig a Hole in the Ground. Most often, though, Darlin' Corey is its name. H.A. Schmidt is 17 and will enter his senior year at Franklin Regional High School. Lives in Bridgeville and has been honored by the Pittsburgh Concert Society as a flautist, and he will be joining us in just a few moments as Youth Express kicks off. Thank you again. If you were playing along in our last hour, I've tried to answer most of the messages and emails that have been coming in. But we get backed up a little bit, which is a great thing. It's not a great thing that we can't always reply. It's a great thing to have your enthusiastic participation. Not only can we engage our minds on a Saturday morning, but also our hearts and each other in a positive way. And another way of doing that is to listen to some talented people. In about half an hour, you're going to hear from a composer who has cerebral palsy and also some limitations on his ability to speak. Despite that, he is an incredible composer, thinker, and I've known Mark Steudel for a long time, and you'll hear an interview with him about an opera that he's currently working on. But right now, we have A.J. Schmidt. He's going to do two selections for us. He's a rising senior at Franklin Regional High School. We will talk with him in between his two selections. first, let's let him play for you. Here is A.J. Schmidt. A.J. Schmidt, and what was the name of what you just played, A.J.?
So that was part of the Bach Partita for Flute. That was Movement 3, which is named Saraband. A saraband is a type of dance, and a partita is typically a larger work, a couple movements long, that's a variation on one melody, and is multiple types of dances from that one melody. So there are other movements to that work that sound similar, but some are faster, one's another slower one. And it's just a really cool piece. And most flutists have to play it many times. So,
well, it was beautiful. When did you discover the flute as being your instrument?
Well, in third grade, we went to our little instrument petting zoo that they have for a lot of elementary schoolers, where you get to go and try all the instruments that you might want to play in fourth grade when you finally get to be in band. And I actually ended up, I wanted to play percussion, but I told the band director that, and he said, oh, well, there's no more percussion spots left, so you have to pick something else. And so my second choice was the flute. But my parents actually really didn't want me to play that because they were like, well, you're a boy, and I don't care if you play the flute, but I don't want other people to bully you because come on, you're a boy. But I was really just stuck on it. I don't know why, and I'm here now, so I'm really glad I did it.
And I'm sure you've done very well for yourself in terms of people not teasing you, or maybe
oh
not.
Yeah, I've actually been fine. So
are your parents here today?
Yeah, they're outside laughing at me. I can see them.
Brittany and Judd Schmidt are here, mom and dad. Also Barbara Heppner is here from the Pittsburgh Concert Society. board, and your brother's here too, and he's also a flute player.
Yeah, he is.
So you broke ground.
I did, yeah.
You broke the brass ceiling, so yeah. to speak. Not brass, I guess, but what are flutes made out of?
Well, typically, a flute is made of silver. It can be made of a ton of different metals, though. The most common is silver. Some, like, student end models are silver-plated, so basically just a fake silver, and some nicer flutes are made out of things like gold and platinum, but then it gets really, really expensive, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Yeah, sure, can. It's a hard... all instruments are hard to master, but there's a lot going on with the flute, especially, I think, in terms of dynamics, being able to play with clarity at a soft volume mm-hmm. and at a louder volume. Mm-hmm. Did you find it challenging?
Oh, yeah. It's still a work in progress. Obviously, like, it wasn't perfect. Like, that performance, like, there's things that I would like to go back and fix still. Especially with, like, dynamics, I was like, oh, there, that wasn't as clear, like you said, as I might have wanted it to be, but it's okay. And the way you work on them is similar, but you end up with a very different embouchure when you're playing loud and trying to not get an unclear tone versus when you're playing soft and trying to get a clearer, more projecting tone.
What about, and I'm not sure if there are arpeggios or what the name for them is, but when you're, you know, doing the fingering that results in kind of a fluttering sound, that would require a lot of dexterity. I would imagine sometimes your head knows what you want your fingers to do, but your fingers might not want to cooperate.
Yeah, so those are common in Baroque music. They're not written into the music. You have to put them in yourself typically. And you just really have to plan them out beforehand. So you either have to write them into the music yourself or just really stick it into your head if you don't write it down there. And before you get there, you have to think about doing it and how am I going to play this in a Baroque style and still move my fingers quickly? Because sometimes when you're going too fast, it's like you do something called romanticizing the music, which is where you play Baroque, but in a different era, kind of. And it becomes inappropriate for Baroque music. So you do have to really watch out with, like, those flutters and stuff.
It sounds like you really have a keen interest in the history of the music you're playing. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about what you might want to do after you graduate next year?
Well, after I graduate, I'll be heading to music school. Obviously, I'm not sure where yet because college applications haven't even opened. But you know, I do have my schools picked out, but yeah, I want to do flute performance. And if you're going to be a performance major, it's incredibly important to understand the history of the music, where it all came from, what era it's from. And that tells you how to play the music, how to interpret it correctly, because you can't play Bach and a composer that's alive today anywhere near the same.
That's really good to hear your perspectives on these things. I know you've probably had some teachers, coaches. Mm-hmm. Would you like to acknowledge them?
Yeah, so my primary teacher is Dan Peraski, so I really need to thank him for everything he's done to me. He's been absolutely amazing. I could not have asked for a better teacher that has a more efficient studio and just has helped me so much. Like, so thank you, Mr. P.
And what about your relationship with the Pittsburgh Concert Society?
Yeah, I do. I need to thank them, of course, too, for this opportunity and for the opportunity to take part in that competition. I feel like doing it has helped me grow as a musician because it's challenging and I need to really push my musical capabilities to, you know, place in it. So thank you very much for everything you've done, PCS.
Before you play your second selection, I was curious what else interests you, what else you like to do beyond music.
Well, you know, normal like teenage stuff, like I play video games and, you know, but I recently started fish keeping as something that's kind of outside of music. It's nice just relaxing, you know, watch the fish swim around. And
you mean having an aquarium
at home?
Yeah,
in my room. Very nice. You just kind of look at them, and it's relaxing and a little bit of a reprieve from the flute sometimes if I need it. I also play a little bit of saxophone. I try and keep that out of, like, competition stuff so I can learn a completely new type of music, jazz, which, you know, isn't very common on the flute. So I didn't know it before I started saxophone. And I try not to compete with it, so then that way I'm not stressed out over that music. And there's music I can just kind of, you know, have around and not have to constantly think about.
Are you playing in marching band or high school ensembles?
Yeah, so I'm in my school's marching band. That's a lot of fun. Just very, you know, different style from what I'm playing right now, obviously, because I'm walking around a field when I'm doing that, not here. I'm also in the Pittsburgh Youth Symphony Orchestra. This will be my fourth year. I appreciate it so much. I've really grown from it. I've learned so much about playing in an orchestra, so much about other composers that don't write a lot of, like, flute music. So, like, Tchaikovsky, or Shostakovich, both of those composers really didn't write any flute solo music, but they're two of my favorites now after being a part of that.
There's some great jazz flute players, too. Not too many of them, but or too many well-known ones, but not to steer you away from classical, but there are a few, and it's amazing to listen.
They are really great. It's a different sound, and it's really cool, actually. I wish I was better at it.
Before we move along, this will be our last chance to chat this morning. Is there anything else you'd like to say that I didn't give you space to say?
Well, obviously, I need to thank my parents. You know, without them, I wouldn't have anything that I have now musically. They've taken me everywhere before I had my license, of course, and paid for everything. So I really appreciate them. And I wanted to introduce my next piece a little. It's one of the Astor Piazzolla Tango Etudes. These etudes were originally for flute or violin, but they've been stolen by about every instrument in the book. They're a type of etude that Piazzolla is really, like, famous for, called Nuevo Tango, which it means new tango. And it's basically a tango. He's from Argentina, which is where they originated, but with jazz and classical, jazz and classical stuff
genre
in it.
or treatments.
Yeah. So that's the type of music he writes, all kind of Latin music for all kinds of instruments or orchestras or bands, and he's a really amazing composer.
Let me tell you, first, thank you in advance for being here. You have a remarkable gift, not just for playing music, but for explaining it in a way that helps listeners who might not know the depth, who very likely don't know the depth behind the composers and the style of music, explaining it in an understandable way.
Thank you.
You're quite good at that.
Thank you.
So I appreciate it. And I can't wait to hear your next piece here. Get ready for some tangos. Is A.J. Schmidt. I'm sorry. A.J. Schmidt, thank you so much for being with us. What a great talent. And you can learn more about the Pittsburgh Concert Society at pittsburghconcertsociety.org.
Goats can eat anything. G-C-E-A. Words to remember, four notes to play. My dog has fleas, you say, but that's just not true. My dog is clean, perhaps cleaner than you. She's fit as a fiddle and clean as a whistle, quite tidy, the bed she lies in. Plus she sleeps in my home, whereas you and your biome, God only knows where you've been. So goats can eat anything, that's how I'll tune my ukulele's four notes. Just leave my dog out of it, for she has no fleas. But I can't speak for you or the goats. Thank you.
Mavis here at the Saturday Light Brigade, and Goats Can Eat Anything, broadcasting live from historic Allegheny Square, along with Ricky Berger. This is Larry Berger, and this is the show that gets your weekend off to a good start, the Saturday Light Brigade, Saturday mornings. From SLB Radio Productions, hello to Daniel in Shepherdstown, who sent along a carrageenan carbonara, which is a vegan thickening agent in a predominantly hard cheese, fatty cured pork, and egg-based pasta dish. That was for our car lot puzzles we were doing before, a double car whammy. You're about to hear a remarkable segment, and I want to prepare you for it just a bit. It's led by Mark Steidel, who is a gifted composer. He has an amazing sense of humor and is one of the most gregarious people I know. I met Mark about 20 years ago. He has a cerebral palsy. And this is a segment we recorded with Mark not too long ago. We wanted to play it today because it's National Disability Independence Day, and Mark is a disability advocate and has been for some time. He is also a composer, an opera librettist, and has been working on a work called The Other Side of Silence with co-composers Catherine Scovira and Robert Whalen. The opera examines the role that art plays in promoting equity and agency for people who use alternate means of communication. One such person is Mark, who speaks using a device called a Dynavox unit. So you'll hear a synthesized voice. I want you to know this is not artificial intelligence. This is Mark's actual direct responses as you listen to this, although the voice will sound synthesized. Such a pleasure now to welcome Mark Steidel to the Saturday Light Brigade. Today we are going to be talking to you about a remarkable opera. It's called The Other Side of Silence. Three guests are here with me. One is Mark Steidel, and before introducing you to Mark, I want to provide a little bit of personal background about him. He's 29. Mark and I met back in 2008 when he and 19 other then teens created an 18-minute radio drama here at our studios called As the Nerd Turns. Mark was born with cerebral palsy, and as he did when we first met, uses a device called a Dynavox to speak. In addition to everything we talk about today, Mark has actively helped the company behind Dynavox refine its products to make them easier to use. Also here with us today are two people from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Dr. Catherine Scovira is a faculty fellow at the School of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences. She's a nationally recognized contemporary music specialist, educator, researcher, and mezzo-soprano. Dr. Robert Whalen serves as lecturer of music and conducting at Rensselaer, where he directs the Rensselaer Orchestra, Concert Choir, and Wind Symphony. So welcome to all of you. I want to open up with Mark. Before we talk about the person you are today, and the opera. I'd like to know a little bit about your childhood, and in particular, when you discovered you had a passion for music and composition, and how you set off to pursue that passion.
I owe this a lot to Fiddlesticks and the Pittsburgh Symphony, because when I was 7, my babysitter would love to take me to the Fiddlesticks series at Hines Hall. Let me say this, I do not remember when I discovered a passion for music, but it was through Lucas Richman, who was a remarkable conductor for the symphony. At the end of every concert, Lucas and his friend Fiddlesticks would have a sing-along to the song, entitled Music Makes Your Life Complete. I just was drawn to that song, and one day Lucas stopped me in the lobby and told my babysitter that he thought I would like going to the Woodlands for a music camp. The Woodlands was where I truly found my passion for music, because teachers educated us and helped me write songs. This is how I pursued my passion. In addition to Hope Academy lessons at East Liberty Presbyterian Church, I want to say one more thing about the symphony. Marvin Hamlisch was the conductor of the pop series until he died, and was a big influence in how I appreciated Broadway music.
I mentioned your involvement as a teen in the SLB radio drama project back in 2008. I remember when I met you so clearly. I was taken with your ability to connect with other teens and apply your skills to the play. At a time of life when people might be unsure of sharing their authentic self, you seem to jump right in. And our dramaturg, Lonnie Cataldi from Point Park, and all of us from SLB were amazed at your ability to do it. Most teens are not as self-assured as you were. I'm curious how you learned to be yourself.
I am not sure how Lonnie Cataldi knew of you. This is my recollection of how I was introduced to you. My mom was taking me to meet Lonnie for the first time at Gemini Theater. I think she had heard about Summer in the City, which, by the way, was fantastic. I think it was near the end of the week when our class went to your studio to record our mystery about how Paris Hilton lost her jewelry box. I believe I vaguely remember meeting you, but that was such a funny mystery about Paris Hilton. But the play took certain skills that I learned in 1 week, like how to be an actor who uses a Dynavox, that, and how to talk really quickly, because I was the advertisement disclaimer for some product we made. But to your question, I had no idea what to expect the day of the broadcast, because unlike you, I was lost when we entered the radio studio, which made me want to take over your computer because it looked cool. I was so intrigued by your equipment, but there is a reason why you operate it and not me. You can correct me, because I feel like I messed up.
I don't think you messed up at all, and I still remember that day so well, and I'm glad we're both laughing about it a little bit. I've listened to that play, and it still holds up really well, almost 15 years later. So now let's just briefly go forward from that time when we were working with each other to college. Can you talk a little bit about your years as a later teen and in your early 20s?
I actually have an ironic high school experience that is relevant to my love for music, and I believe I was a freshman or sophomore when I chose to take orchestra. The orchestra teacher, who I never met, was the husband of the band teacher at the Woodlands, and his name was Dodd Busch Yeager. I found that to be an awesome coincidence, because you never know who will come into your life. I think the next year, I was in the musical, entitled Back to the 80s, where I was the narrator. What was so funny about that was that I needed a costume. And back then, I loved the show called Glee. Being me, I decided to look like the character, Artie, who used a wheelchair and always wore a brown vest.
So many things combine to lead people to new moments. And a new moment includes today. The other side of silence is the opera you're developing. Let's talk a little bit about the storyline.
I will hand this over to Catherine, because you crafted the storyline around my gender identity and communication device use.
Thank you, Mark. This is Catherine here, and Larry, thank you so much for having us on this show to talk about The Other Side of Silence. I should share, it actually comes from a quote by Marianne Evans, whose pen name we would all know, George Eliot, from her book Middlemarch. And it reads, "If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary human life, it would be like hearing the grass grow and the squirrel's heartbeat, and we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence." It's funny that you mentioned never knowing when special people will come into your lives. And Mark really is an incredible person that Robert and I had the opportunity to meet through the advocacy work that we were doing in Philadelphia. It actually came down to being introduced to Lisa Sonnenborn, who is Director of Media Arts and Culture at Temple University's Institute on Disabilities. And this is how we met Mark. It was through a project with Lisa at the Institute on Disabilities and the Curtis Institute when we created Lost Time with Robert Evans and No Words with Sarah Pishka and with Mark Steidel. Now, I should mention that Sarah Pishka, which is P-Y-S-Z-K-A, is a wonderfully accomplished author and publisher and AEC user herself. Now, Robert and Mark and I wanted to create a new work through this opera, The Other Side of Silence, and center a person with disabilities at the very heart of this opera, because some of the efforts that we've seen across the industry haven't made the kind of strides that we would hope for in terms of access and advocacy. And so we decided that we would base The Other Side of Silence on the real life experiences of Mark and over 7 years of research by Robert and myself. And I should mention, this is where the work of Sarah Pishka comes in, because we are deeply influenced by her 2020 book, Inside My Outside, An Independent Mind in a Dependent Body. And I really recommend that you go check out that book.
7 years of research is incredible. You all got to know each other extremely well, I would imagine. How did you go about doing that?
This is Robert, and thank you again. The first time we worked together was on the project that Catherine mentioned called Lost Time. And the idea of Lost Time was that both Mark and Robert Evans wrote poetry that reflected on their time during the pandemic as AAC users and the increased isolation that was felt. And as we got to know Mark better, we learned more about their life and their personal experience, and also their use of an AAC device, which is augmentative and alternative communication, which we called the Dynavox earlier. And for as many benefits as these devices give, which are wonderful, certainly there are some drawbacks, in as much as the idea of having a custom synthetic voice is not something that is covered by insurance and is often prohibitively expensive for most AAC users. So oftentimes there's usually about 6 stock voices that come with an AAC device. And if you think, like I do, that your voice is tied to your identity, intrinsically tied to your identity, I mean, if you hear yourself thinking in your own head, whose voice do you hear? I hear my own most of the time, I would say. If that is not something that is accessible to you, then the sense of identity that you have becomes tethered to someone else's voice. It began us having many very interesting conversations and discussions, and this was the kindling for the opera, The Other Side of Silence.
Thanks for clarifying that. If you're just with us, you're listening to a conversation with Mark Steudel, Dr. Catherine Scovira, and Dr. Robert Whalen. We're talking about an opera that is emerging called The Other Side of Silence, and we'll talk more about that. Now, one thing I noted is there are a lot of collaborations, Mark. Can you explain some of the unique ones?
So there is a nightmare scene that I cannot pronounce, and this might be the most unique visual collaboration. Robert can tell you more.
Thank you, Mark. I would like to, you know, first acknowledge our primary collaborators on the project, certainly Opera Saratoga and their incredible artistic director, Mary Birnbaum, has been like a guiding light for this project. It was with Mary's advocacy that we applied for and received a grant from the New York State Council for the Arts, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and the Curtis R. Priam Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute were also integral in getting this project off the ground, as well as supporting and housing the workshop that we developed. Because this opera deals with someone who uses a synthetic voice, who uses an AAC, we wanted to explore how far we could push the envelope of the synthetic voice, both in speech and in singing. And we happened to be at the dawn of an extraordinary time for the AI voice, especially the sung artificially intelligent voice. We partnered for our first workshop with Dream Tonics, which is a Tokyo-based AI firm, vocal AI firm, and we used their product called Synthesizer V, which now is in its second edition. And the idea is that you can input notes and text and have a particular vocal character assigned to it, and it will realize it and sing it. And it's an absolutely extraordinary product. The nightmare scene that Mark mentioned is something called the Lichttanz, which in German is the dance of light. You know, we were trying to come up with a word that would catch what this moment was. And this dance of light was inspired by something called Perlin noise. It's an algorithmic process that's used in computer graphics and animation to create realistic landscapes and textures. And what we did was instead use the two-dimensional representation of Perlin noise as a fodder for discerning the musical material as well as the images that were projected on the screen. And what's amazing about this Perlin noise is if you start to look at these patterns long enough, they don't appear dissimilar from patterns that you see as trees as they develop, or the patterns of rivers as they cut across a landscape, or the patterns of roads in a city before urban planning, or in neurons in the brain, or galactic filaments, etc. You start to see these patterns everywhere. You could say it's the pattern of life. And these patterns, in their two-dimensional form, are the very first thing we see and hear in the opera. And it's supposed to represent the near infinite capacity of the mind, as well as the inherent link between a seemingly algorithmic process that is tied to our own existence and experience. I think I should pass this over to Catherine to talk also more about the storyline of the opera, because I'm throwing you right into it without any additional context.
Well, we have a character named Zari. They are a 21-year-old gender non-binary person with disabilities who uses AAC. And the voice actually starts out as female identifying in the first act, and it evolves right along with the technology that we are exploring right now. And Zari lives in a home with their mother, Grace. The father is not in the picture, and that's something that evolves through the opera as to why. There's a character, Helen, who is Zari's caretaker and as much a part of the family as Grace, the mom, as is Diego, Zari's best friend, who is also a poet. And then somehow, in the midst of the many questions and tensions in Act One, where we learn that Zari has opted into a new program, we meet another character who really doesn't feature until the second and third act, and this is Kim, or the Kimura. This is the smart home voice which somehow has this ominous presence in Act One. And before we go into why that would be, I'll just give you a general sketch of the rest of the opera, which is that Zari wakes to this incredible play of light and shadow on their walls. It's one of the things that, that Zari relates to the most, which is that that waiting and silence before the day starts, because as you mentioned, Larry, people will be experiencing this opera differently based on their life experiences. If we are waiting for someone to help us out of bed, that creates a different kind of expectation than if one gets oneself out of bed. Robert and I have colleagues who are working on robotic systems that could address this. But that's where the many needs that we have as people and that, that understanding of a variety of experiences can lead the arts and technology. Really, back to the plot, I'd say that Zari is actively trying to find their way and their agency in a world that doesn't seem to want them to explore or think differently. Ultimately, the strength of Zari's character and the understanding of who they are and what they love that brings the opera to a really climactic close.
As I think about it, your work here involves evolution and transformation of a lot of things. Zari, for one, changes throughout the production, right? Technology is also changing. The audience's perceptions, hopefully, are changing as well. And it sounds like it's really going to be an important work. I know it's still a work in progress. And I think, Mark, turning to you, what's next?
Being that this is a work in process, we are essentially building it in pieces. In workshops, we try out material and meet partners for the premiere production. So we have completed Act 1 and are working on Acts 2 and 3 now. The whole opera should be finished by 2026. Catherine can tell you more about how common this is in opera and what is next for the project.
In this case, the technology, the libretto, and the music are all evolving because they're informing each other. There's a real interplay here. So I would say that we're working on this opera across three linked fronts. The technology to develop the synthetic voice, which does sing in Act One. The libretto itself and the composition. And these are all so deeply informed with each other that I want to turn it over to Robert, because you heard some of his conception about overall structure, and we'll be constantly making tweaks to help this vision move forward.
Thank you, Catherine. What we're looking forward to next, from the point of view of the composer and from a technological perspective as it pertains to the composition of the music, includes a deeper dive into the expressive and technological possibilities of the synthetic voice and how it appears in the performance space. Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute has developed a technology called wave field synthesis, which is an array of speakers, sometimes up to 500 or more small speakers, which can create a two-dimensional hologram of sound in space. This allows us to very specifically position the voice or voices inside the performance space. And as Catherine mentioned earlier, we're dealing with an entity called the Chimera, which is an entire house, like an entire smart home, which you can take as perhaps a Freudian metaphor for the mind. The entire performance space then becomes a character. And we start now to experiment with placement, direction, and locality of sound, meaning like who in the audience does or does not hear certain parts of the story. So the next workshops will be focusing on Act Two, where Mark's character, Zari, enters the Omni House, where we meet the Chimera, and begins to interface with this character, Kim, in new and unexpected and potentially dangerous ways.
It really has me thinking maybe it's a meta experience. I don't know what to name it. I just know this would have me thinking, which is the sign of a really good piece of work. Thanks. I want to turn back to Mark, who really is the origin of the entire concept here, the other side of silence. Mark, turning away from the opera for a second, I know you're a board member of Disability Rights Pennsylvania, as well as a program manager for a group called Self-Advocacy Voices. These are both groups that encourage adults with disabilities or mental health issues to speak up for themselves. Do you have any advice for people who might be uncomfortable speaking up or sharing their authentic self?
People with disabilities need to have peers without disabilities. That is why I went to regular school starting in kindergarten through the time I graduated from Brashear High School in 2013. There were two factors that helped me speak up: education and how teachers addressed me. Most teachers were demanding which is the right way to be, but I remember some who would lose control of a class. Those teachers taught me without knowing how to speak up for myself and say I want to be in an advanced class. Mental health is bigger in my opinion because it is a stigmatized issue, whereas disability awareness is rooted in American history. I am sorry to say my advice would have to be individualized because everyone is different, but I think we all need a mentor to help us navigate uncomfortable situations.
I suspect there might be some fundamentals that all of us should consider simply when interacting with people with disabilities. Even people with the best of intentions are often uncertain of what to do. Any advice there?
Sometimes history goes untaught, or even worse, it goes ignored. When people do not acknowledge disability history and the oppression people with disabilities have faced, this is how misperceptions occur by people without disabilities. I do believe everyone has good intentions when they talk to people with disabilities, but the problem is that there is a lack of education surrounding disability history outside of college programs or agencies supporting people with disabilities. Where we get our education should be more widely available, not just in colleges. What are your thoughts, Robert and Catherine?
Well, I would say that in my experience, the world of disabilities is incredibly diverse. And the more that people are open to the experiences of others, the more we're educating ourselves about how to make connections and what is possible across many different facets of humanity, that's where we thrive. And I will say that as an opera singer, that is not built into how opera is taught, nor how the relationships are maintained once we move out of the student realm into the professional world. And that's why The Other Side of Silence is so exciting, because it's an opportunity for people to experience something new and question what we thought our fundamentals were and step into something that is much more collaborative and hopeful.
I think it's also something, hopefully a forum where we can reflect on how we all have varying abilities. The very idea of technology is that it's supposed to do something that we wouldn't be able to do ourselves. So I think the idea of confronting our own abilities, where we can all interface with technology, where we all find our limits, is an amazing point of unification.
Turning back to the opera, Mark, how can people keep track and follow the progress as it develops?
I will turn this over to Robert and Catherine.
Well, we will point you to our collaborators with Opera Saratoga. You can find them at www.operasaratoga.org. And you can also check out the recent New York Times article that came out in October of 2024 on The Other Side of Silence. Can a synthetic voice be taught to sing opera?
finally, I can't believe how quickly our time has gone. I'd like to make sure you all have a chance to say anything I may have neglected to ask. And Mark, I'll start with you. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Actually, I would like to talk about how I view arts and accessibility, because it is a very important concept to me when I think about the performing or even visual arts. I understand the necessity of adapting how people with disabilities can contribute to this profession. Knowing that each art form is different, there is no universal strategy to make this profession accessible. If you think about that on a deeper level, that is what makes art so beautiful to produce.